used to using a microphone calling Bingo.
Oh, well.
But,
we are testing our equipment this morning. Is that enough?
Well, the leader runs out.
Yeah.
And I would think by this time we've got something.
Get out for lead time. See how it's changing? Okay.
Just testing.
Do you want to say something?
Just testing now. This is the Lawrenceburg Public Library Oral History Project. We would like to interview Mr. Anneking on the 1937 flood.
This is Doris Marple at the Lawrenceburg Public Library on July the 15th, 1982. We are happy to interview Mr. Edwin Anneking this morning for our local history project having to do with the flood of 1937. We surely appreciate, Mr. Anneking, your coming in this morning and
You're welcome.
Us some thoughts of what you remember about the flood of 1937.
My recollection of the 37 flood started the day before. I was working in Seeger's office in a room facing Ridge Avenue, and the traffic coming out of Lawrenceburg was two lanes coming out and one lane going back in. People were hauling, we were frightened, and they were taking out of town what they could carry in their cars. And it was raining very hard all day long, and I recall seeing a teenage boy, I think, pushing a bicycle with a mattress draped over the handlebars. He was using the sidewalk, so that might mean the third lane going out to Greendale. Later in the day, I was asked to help one of the other men in the office move some rugs and books from a house in Old Town down to the attic. So he got crawled up in the attic, and we shoved carpets up there and all kinds of books, and suddenly I heard a noise and I looked up. He'd slipped off of the ceiling joist, and 1 foot came down on each side of the joist right through the ceiling. We might have saved all that trouble because the house was all underwater and his books all got wet in the attic anyway. He moved his refrigerator and some of the furniture to a secret building over on 2nd Street, which is known as the Bauer property. And that also was a mistake. If he left them where they were, all he had to do was dry out the motors and clean it up, and he had a refrigerator. But as it happened, this old Bauer shed property floated off the foundation, and everything in it fell down from the second floor into the basement and was all dented up and useless. Long in the evening, I was asked to help a bunch of other office workers go down to the Siegel's bottling house, where they had a bunch of imported case goods stored in the basement, which they wanted to move out. And somebody broke a hole through the concrete floor, and they passed all those cases, and I don't know how many there were, several hundred at least, passed them up through the hole in the floor, and we piled them up on the first floor. And that also was a wasted energy, that because the water got them anyway. Prior to that, during the day, Seagrams had loaded out from their shipping department, which was in the basement of the bottling house, and loaded it into boxcars. But then, because of the high water, the railroad was not permitted to run a train across the levee, so the only place they could go with these 45 boxcars was on the siding that led to Greendale, and that didn't have enough room. So all those boxcars full of case goods were all soaked and damaged. So sometime after the flood, Seagrams bought about four dozen square wash tubs, and they had to unload all those boxcars into wash tubs and take them back into the bottling house and recondition them bottle by bottle. As we came out of the bottling house, which was somewhere close to midnight, we tried to walk the rails to keep our feet dry because the water was already up over the cross ties. And I got up to the office, and somebody, perhaps a Red Cross, had furnished some broth, beef broth, that was made years before that during the Dust Bowl when they were rescuing cattle that were starving. They slaughtered them, and the government made this beef broth, and later on we also got some of the beef, all in gallon-sized cans. For this work detail that I helped with moving books and rugs and case goods, somebody issued me a pair of bib overalls, and I don't know where they came from, but they were issued, and there was a lot of them issued to various people. While I was eating this beef broth in the Seagram's office building, the bells and the whistles and things all told, marking the time when the levee broke and the Lawrenceburg was flooded. I went back to my room out on Nolan Avenue, where I rented a room in a private home, and the next morning I went back to work. I went back to the office and reported to for a duty. There was no office work going on, so they asked me to drive my car, and I drove an old Dr. Figley around for some house calls. We couldn't get very far. We couldn't get as far as Lawrenceburg Junction because the road beyond was underwater, and it was just a few calls in Greendale. When I had finished with that, then I did relief driving, meeting the boats that were coming up Main Street and bringing people out of town. As the flood progressed, the boat laning moved up. Now, there really wasn't any boat laning or dock. The boats ran until they hit the street, and then men in hip boots carried the people over to dry land. So after that was about a Friday. I'm not sure of the days, but I think it was Friday and Saturday and Sunday that we were involved in this hauling people out. Saturday, most of the people found relatives or friends in Greendale they could stay with. But as the town of Greendale filled up, all we could do was take them to another boat landing, and then they were hauled across Tanner's Creek, either up, probably up Ludlow Hill to Refugee and some other areas. I know some went to Rushville and Connersville. They had relatives in other areas that they went to, or some of them had to go to strangers' houses. I was recalling one particular instance excuse me, of a lady who probably was middle-aged or slightly beyond, and a daughter probably in her young, around 20. And the daughter was all distraught. She says, "Mama, what are we going to do?" And Mama said, Mama said, "When the water goes down, we go back down in there and we'll shovel out the mud and scrub up and move back in. What else can we do?" I think the mother had been through something like this before, perhaps in 1913, but it was all new and all most disheartening to the younger girl. By Monday, they had moved practically all of the people out of town, and I parked my car out in Greendale. The garage I'd rented had long since been taken over for storing furniture, and I gave the keys to the landlady, and I got back down, caught a Chris Craft boat out of across Tanner's Creek to the foot of Ludlow Hill. As I started walking up the hill, wondering how I was going to get to my parents' home in Oldenburg, I recognized an automobile, and I went back in the crowd, and I found a man that lived next door to my parents, and I asked him if I could ride to Oldenburg with him, and he said yes, just a little bit. He had brought down a load of boots and various other relief supplies and had been ferried across into town. One thing I do, a few things I remember about the picking up the refugees or the people coming in boats was one of the ladies who had worked with me in the office fact, she was working with me at that time. Had lived in Old Town and had taken refuge with some friends in Newtown, in an area that had never been in water. But this 37 flood was higher than it had before, and they had to be vacated from there. Now, they had gotten the more distant people first, so when they came to pick these people up, they told them, oh, some while before, we'll get you on the next trip, but don't bring anything with you except what you're wearing, because they had been overloaded with so much stuff that people were trying to bring along in the boats. So I remember this girl being carried out of the boat wearing two coats and three hats all tied down with a big scarf. She brought only what she was wearing. The highest point in Old Town was the courthouse, a three-story building, and a lot of people took refuge over there. And I remember seeing some people that came from when they were brought over from the courthouse. They brought probably the most valuable thing, at least the thing that they had needed the most in the courthouse. Of course, there wasn't any restroom facilities or anything else, but I can remember some man walking up the sidewalk in Greendale proudly swinging a big white chamber pot. Which had been their convenience in the courthouse, and of course they dumped it out of the window when they used it, and then it was ready for another one. There, I don't know how many people, but there may have been 25 or 30 people in the courthouse.
Refugees. On the third floor.
On the third floor. When I got to Oldenburg, I had nothing much to do there. My reading glasses were in my desk when I went to work. I left them there when I went refugee helping. I left them there, so I didn't have my reading glasses, and I couldn't read the paper, and about the only thing you could get on the radio was Louisville stations, WHAS. And not being familiar with Louisville, it didn't mean too much to me. But I found out later that one of the announcers on the Louisville station is well known these days as Foster Brooks, the comedian. After spending a week at Oldenburg listening to mostly to the radio, there weren't any televisions in those days, of course. On a Monday, gotten to Oldenburg, my father and I drove to Batesville, and we went to some office, and I don't know whether it was a National Guard or a Red Cross or who, but we went to somewhere in office in Batesville to get a permit so we could get past the guards so I could get back down to Lawrenceburg. And we got the papers, and I drove back down to Lawrenceburg, down to the foot of Ludlow Hill, and turned the car around for my father, and then sought a ride for myself. Now, whereas I had left town in a Chris-Craft, I went back in a John boat with the mail. They were hauling United States mail in the same John boat. So then I reported back to Seagram's to work. That's where I arrived anyway. That's where the John boat landed, in the Seagram property, and then back to my room in Greendale. The landlady told me that they'd been using my room, and would it be all right if they sent somebody to sleep with me? And I said, oh, sure. So I went to bed at my usual hour, and having been rather tired, and when I woke up in the morning, there was a high school boy in bed with me, and he was still asleep. The same thing went on two more nights before I finally found out and got introduced to the guy I had been sleeping with. I also was able to find out some of the things that had gone on other than the relief part that I'd been doing, the driving. The Seagram office had been taken over almost immediately for various relief purposes. The morning after the levee broke, the Indiana State Police came in with a shortwave system, and they used one of the upstairs offices, and they strung a wire from the office building over to a tall building, the mill building, for an antenna, and they were providing emergency communications. My office had been taken over and became the operating room, and there were some operations in there and probably some babies born. Another office across the hall was taken over as the contagious ward, and they must have had some patients there. And the main accounting office had been taken over as the as a hospital ward. Some beds had been set up in there. The desks were all stacked and double and triple deck to get them out of the way, because there wasn't really any place to take them. The boilers at Seagram's had been flooded out, so that, and Seagram's had their own electrical generators, but they ran two steam locomotives up the track close to the generator room, and ran pipes from those locomotives over to the generators, and by firing those steam engines provided steam to run Seagram's generators, which provided the electricity for the whole town of Greendale, with the limitation that each house was limited to one light. Now, that was quite a problem. The house that I lived in was a three-bedroom house, and they took in various refugees, friends of theirs, the guy I didn't know, who I slept with. Iva Leek and her mother were there, and there were two couples in the basement, each one with a baby, separated by sheets strung across on a line. And it was rather unique to hear a baby cry, because when the baby cried in the basement, the sounds came right up through the hot air ducts. Across the street, Miller's house was a boarding house that I'd eaten at for quite a few years. They had about 50 people in there. So many people that they kept a roster of who went to bed and when they went to bed, so when somebody else wanted to go to bed, they'd look and see who'd had the most sleep. They'd wake them up, and
that's
your time to get up.
Mom Miller.
That's right.
Yeah.
Or Yubi's
no,
parents.
My husband stayed there when he first came.
Yeah.
There.
So that's some idea of the crowding. Most of the refugee work, there were a few people had some power boats that could fight the current, but most of the refugee work was done with Coast Guard lifeboats that were brought in by rail from New Haven, Connecticut, and they did the primary hauling jobs, bringing
by
people.
By rail, you mean like the New York...
on the railroad, yeah, they brought it in and unloaded them up at the Lawrenceburg Junction, and they drove them through the water the rest of the way. Mm-hmm. The main channel of the Miami River used to be right alongside of Ridge Avenue. There's a low spot, if you take the time to look wherever something has been built up to you, there's a low spot right along Ridge Avenue, was the old channel. Well, during the flood, that's where the main channel diverted, so all the current, there was a very, very strong current right in along there. That's the reason why you had to use power boats to get into the area to do the rescuing. After a few days, there were state policemen from Massachusetts came in and relieved the Indiana state policemen on the shortwave radio communications. Seagram's upstairs, the ladies' restroom and lounge was converted into a kitchen, and an office across the hall became a dining room for all the people that were working, and like the state police and anyone else. There weren't any restaurants available. And I suppose all the food and supplies and things that for the eating came from the Red Cross. And Mrs. Wonker was the major domo of the kitchen, and with help from some of the other ladies, and we all ate, and they took shifts eating in an office that would hold probably no more than two dozen at a time. And I was very interested one evening sitting in there, and there was two Massachusetts state policemen there eating. And that evening we had scrambled eggs with hominy in it. And one of the men had never seen hominy. And he asked the other fellow, he said, "What's this in there?" He said, "Well, that's a kind of a rare egg of a bird mixed in with the scrambled eggs." And he really didn't know, and he offered. He said, "When this flood goes down, we'll go out and we see if we can't catch some of those hominy birds." And this fella didn't know any better. And
wasn't he ever told?
I guess he eventually found out. But up east, they'd never heard of hominy. If he never went south, had never heard of hominy. One guy pulled the other guy's leg, and I had a very hard time keeping a straight face. That pretty well, and that takes care of time until the water went down. I may think of some more items that you can insert up where they belong. After the water went down, there was an office somewhere set up. You had to have, there was National Guard on patrol, which I referred to previously, about having to get a permit to get back into Lawrenceburg. So they patrolled the town, and you had to pass a checkpoint with your permit in order to get back in there. Now, one of the girls in the office lived on Front Street in the building that Dr. Pfeiffer's office was located for quite a few years. And so she had a minimum of clothing, and everybody had to wear what was on their back. And there was a shortage of power for pumping water and all that, so everybody had to make do. She got permit and asked me if I would go with her to see if we'd get in her house. And she lived there with her grandmother, and her grandmother had gone somewhere in the state. So I got a permit and went with her, and it was quite a task to walk from Seagram's to Front Street. There was about an inch of slippery mud over everywhere. It hadn't really dried off yet, so you had to take short steps like you were walking on ice. So we got to the house, and she said, "There's a ladder in this woodshed." Well, wood is light, and the wood floats. So the wood had floated all around in the woodshed, and we had to wiggle quite a while on the door before we could get enough wood moved out of the way to open it and to get in and get the ladder. So we put the ladder up to a second story porch and crawled up the ladder, and the last step was a big one, but we did make it, and we got the upstairs door open. Her clothing was all hanging on hangers very neatly and very fine and not at all damaged. But her shoes were all on the floor, and they'd all been in water because it had been about 5 or 6 inches deep on the second story. So she found a bushel basket from somewhere, and she loaded a bunch of her clothes in the bushel baskets. And maybe she took some of the shoes along, don't know. But we were rather fearful of trying to step down from that second story porch down to the top of a 6-foot ladder. And so we decided to go out another route. There was a spiral stairway to go down, and it also was covered with about a half inch of slippery mud. And a window pane broken out right at the side above the sidewalk, which was left a glass hole through the sash big enough to crawl through. But it becomes quite a problem to crawl head first through a window and land on the windowsill and try to figure out how you're going to get feet first down onto the ground. But eventually we did make it, and we did get the bushel basket out and her out with them. I went out first, so she had a little easier time of it, and we carried her basket and clothes between us and back out to Greendale forever, where she was staying. Later on, after the flood had come along a little bit, a little more in the history, and you didn't need permits to get into town, I walked over and stopped at Klepper's, and Ed was in there trying to clean up the mud, and I asked him if he had a beer around. He says, "Yeah, it's been in the flood." So he opened it and we wiped it, and I think I had the first beer in Klepper's after the flood.
Klepper's was on Main Street.
On 3rd Street, on Highway 50. Yeah. It's been torn down to make part of the progressive building and loan. The current being so strong, it had washed out almost all of High Street, of the High Road, which is Highway 50. The area is all built up around there now. But there was only one slab of concrete pavement still remaining of that, what's now Highway 50. The rest of the sidewalk, the drive and the street, the sidewalks and most of the field had been washed out. So that became the most popular place for dumping mattresses and pianos and sofas and everything else that people had to throw away. You don't really think too much about the things that have to be thrown away, but when water gets into a piano and swells all that wood inside of it, it becomes practically useless. Mattresses the same way, and overstuffed furniture and things like that. I was amused, and I think it was a true story. Bob Albright lived over on Elm Street. His sister still lives in the same place. They went over and to clean out, and they threw out Victrola and a bunch of records and things like that, getting in the house, clean up the house. And then after they had the house cleaned up, they went out in the yard to clean up. And they thought, well, now you know those records, they could be cleaned up. We don't really have to throw them away. So they started picking up the records. And the first one he picked up was Beautiful Ohio.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was immediately broken right over his knee.
Oh.
Let me see if I can think of anything more.
What did they do then with the furniture that had to be thrown away? Did they have a dump of some kind?
Well, that was the original dump, and then when they got to rebuilding the road, they had to move it somewhere else, but they all had to be moved to a dump. As I got over into further into town, that was particularly down along High Street, it was obvious that the country conveniences had been pretty well moved out of Lawrenceburg, because there were chick sales hanging on telephone wires all over the place. And for the convenience of people that were trying to clean out their areas down in Old Town, a manhole had been removed from a sewer at the corner of Walnut and High Streets, and a chick sale had been placed right over the sewer entrance so that people could use restrooms in the middle of the street. It took quite a long while for people to get moved back into their houses. It took a long while for them to dry out. I remember helping a friend. They had white enameled woodworks, and all that paint had to be scraped off, and then so they let the wood dry before they could paint it. In many cases, plaster had to be repaired. A lot of floors had to be taken up, dried, and relaid. So it was most of the summer before most of the people got their homes habitable again, the ones that were not swept away, and there were a lot of them also. I guess that's about it.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah.
If you got an afterthought, when I got over into Newtown, what's 3rd Street then, Highway 50 and East Parkway now, I was surprised to see that the street was practically full of vehicles. Lawrenceburg Fire engines were all parked there, and there was a couple of semi-trailer trucks, tractors parked along there. The street was full of cars. It had never been flooded before. The fire engines had been completely submerged, and I noticed one particular tractor trailer had a high water mark that was about 8 inches from the top of the trailer, to give an idea how deep the water was at that area of town. That's it.
Amazing.
During the time I was driving a car on relief duty, I was asked to deliver some medicines or something to Shanley's, and I didn't know where Shanley's was, and I was driving in Greendale, and I saw some man along the street. I said, "Can you tell me where Mary Street is?" He says, "Yeah, over in Old Town, 25 feet underwater." He didn't realize either that there was another Mary Street in Greendale. As I mentioned off tape, in order to have access into Seagram's plant, the regular access was underwater. They tore down a fence between the Seagram's office building and the G warehouse, and they laid boards across the grass to provide a vehicular entrance into the distillery area. Just in passing, I recall that the water was 6 feet deep on the bottling line, on the bottling floor at the bottling house. So besides losing all their case goods loaded in the boxcars, they also lost all the blended whiskeys in the blending and bottling tanks. Also, a lot of barrels that were around. Then, as now, Seagram's always had a stack of empty barrels, and they tried to corral them. I think Harry Seibel was a warehouse superintendent at that time. They tried to corral them, put a fence or stretch a rope or something around it, but that didn't work. So those whiskey barrels were floating down the Ohio River all the way down. I'm sure they went past Louisville. And some kids got hurt afterwards from as a result of that. They'd find a barrel after the water went down, and they'd pull the bung and strike a match to see what was in it. And some of those barrels exploded then. Maybe you can shut off now.